Welcome to the Florida Specifier Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Matthews, joined as always by my co-host, Brett Cyphers. Doing something a little out of the ordinary today, but we're excited to bring it to you. Brett had the opportunity to interview former Ag Commissioner Adam Putnam, now current Ducks Unlimited CEO. Their discussion was wide-ranging, talking a little bit about the citrus industry in Florida, how Adam got into politics at such a ripe young age, and then his time obviously in Florida and now splitting time between Memphis and our great state here. I'm very excited about it. I had the opportunity to work with Commissioner Putnam while I was at DEP. Always enjoyed our interactions and just really the knowledge that he had on all issues. I think it's going to be a real good listen. And for us, as I said, a little bit of uncharted territory. We're doing a bit of a crossover with Brett's enormously successful Water for Fighting podcast. We decided to expand the scope and audience and bring that conversation to our Florida Specifier listeners as well. I think you'll see a lot more of this as we move forward. We're trying new things. We're trying to be adaptable, all for you, the listener. So we hope you enjoy.
All right. Today, I'm honored to welcome Bartow's favorite son, Adam Putnam, to the show. He was, at the time he served, the youngest person ever to be elected to the Florida House of Representatives at barely 22 years old. He was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for five terms, becoming the third-ranking member of that body, Florida's 11th Commissioner of Agriculture for two terms, that's all you're allowed to get, the first elected official to receive the U.S. Water Prize from the U.S. Water Alliance, a 2021 inductee into the Florida Citrus Hall of Fame, and he is now the CEO of Ducks Unlimited. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, I agree. So I'll confess, and we talked just a minute before we started, that I have a bit of a tick, and I don't know if it comes from the Army or how I feel about Florida, which is that it's better than everywhere else in the country. I'm guessing that yours is modified a bit based on your current location, but I typically refer to someone as the highest rank that they held in the state of Florida. And so I'll call you Adam if that's okay, but if I slip into commissioner, I will apologize in advance for that.
Well, either one's better than what most people call me, so that's fine. We'll roll with it.
Yeah, I guess we'll talk about politics later on. But first, I want to start by talking about your parents and your grandparents. And we'll get to your father's famous side of the family, but at least famous to me. But let's begin with your mother and her family. Where was she from? Who were her parents? And where were they from?
Yeah, so my mom also was born and raised in Bartow. And I asked my grandfather one time when she and my dad started dating. And he said, your mother's had her hooks in him since the second grade. And her mom was from Alabama. Her dad was in the officer in the National Guard and University of Florida graduate, and was part of a small law firm in Bartow called Holland, Beavis, and Hughes. He's the Hughes in the family. So he was partners with Spessard Holland in the firm that eventually became Holland and Knight.
Wow.
But he died when my mom was 6 months old from complications from appendicitis. So she actually never knew her father because she was a baby when he died.
Wow. And so was she raised simply by her mother? Or, I mean, did she ever get remarried?
No, never remarried. She raised those girls on her own.
You said her mom was from Alabama. Where in Alabama?
Oh, my gosh. It'll come to me like 10 minutes after we end the podcast.
That's okay.
It's not far from Anniston, but it's a real colorful name, the name of the town. And her dad was a doctor.
Okay. Well, let's move to your father's side then a bit. And forgive me if I mispronounce the middle name here. And so I want you to talk to me about Dudley Adelbert Putnam. Did I get that right?
Adelbert, yeah.
Adelbert.
It's Adelbert. It's a terrible name. No one's ever worried about naming the next generation that name. But yeah, his family was actually originally from Chicago. And his wife, my paternal grandmother, she had the really deep Florida roots. Her family, you know, were her uncle's sister married Mr. Watson, you know, the famous Watson, the murderer from the 10,000 Islands. And she was, you know, the Langfords and the Libasses and all those old family names from Fort Myers who ran cattle with Jacob Summerlin. And she actually spent part of her childhood in Cuba because her dad decided, well, we're rounding up all these cattle in Florida and shipping them to Cuba. Why don't we just go start a ranch in Cuba? So they did that for a little while. And, you know, she used to joke that she learned Spanish before she learned English.
Wow.
Yeah, and so real interesting story, and her her mother ran the grocery store in Bartow, Main Street, the Main Street Market forever, and was also a great, tough woman, just like my maternal grandmother. So, yeah, good stock, good genes, blessed on all sides to have had some wonderful role models who were active in Florida.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I think it was his own Citrus Hall of Fame, or maybe his Agriculture Hall of Fame, probably did both. But your grandfather was quoted as saying, in relation to working on agriculture issues in Florida, when I finished one battle, it was time to take up another. There's always another challenge. And it sounds like you get that, maybe that sentiment from both sides of your family at this point. Is that foreshadowing for your own life and your profession?
Well, certainly a lot of lessons I learned from my grandfather. He wasn't terribly sentimental. He was tough. And so that sort of summarizes his worldview. You know, He had several phrases that we still use. You know, if you take care of the little things, the big things take care of themselves, and All forward motion, no backing up. And, you know, so he certainly had faced a lot of adversity in his life, and certainly kind of carving out a part of the citrus industry and being part of its, you know, really modernization post-World War II. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, he was really just what they called a bird dogger, where you owned your own truck and you would go pay cash for fruit, and then you would haul it to the northern markets in Philly and New York and Washington and And Boston, and usually kind of barter along the way. So, you know, you'd climb up in the back of your truck and trade oranges for a meal or for a night's sleep or whatever. Well, at the outbreak of World War II, he knew how precious rubber supplies would be. So he went out and bought a brand new set of truck tires immediately at the outbreak. And my dad tells the story that they were under the bed in the upstairs bedroom. They were the most precious thing that they owned, because it was the key to keeping the business going, this brand new set of truck tires that they literally hid under the bed.
Wow.
So, yeah, it gives you a sense of, you know, the kinds of things that they dealt with that fortunately we don't have to think a lot about, but It made them tough.
Then let's get to your father then. Is that when the way that your grandfather was doing business, did that find a sense of permanence when he did it? Or at what point did you start to have more the larger, the Putnam Groves, the citrus, as well as the cattle aspects of the family business?
Yeah, that was my grandfather who began, you know, he sort of went from buying fruit to buying a grove and then another. And, you know, that kind of followed the pace of growth within the citrus industry. You know, it was transformed with the advent of frozen concentrate, which was a World War II funded experiment to find ways to get vitamin C to the troops in a shelf stable way. So, of course, after the war, Florida was never the same, and the industry was never the same. And certainly he benefited from that. And then my father certainly did his part to continue to invest in groves and in the cattle business. That's where we still find ourselves today.
Yeah. I mean, and going fairly strong at that. Tell me about the cattle side a little bit. I grew up in Sefner, and so in the middle of orange trees and strawberry fields. But tell me a little bit about the cattle side of that family business.
Well, growing up in the 80s, you know, you had one record-breaking freeze after another, which we really haven't seen a freeze since 89 as bad as the ones in 81, 83, 85, and 89. And so it was pretty depressing, frankly, to grow up in the citrus business, because every summer when you'd go work in the groves, you were pruning and replanting dead trees from the previous freeze, from the previous winter. And so cattle were a lot more fun, especially, you know, if you liked to ride horses and you had a chance at seeing a deer or seeing a bald eagle or, you know, just, it's just way more fun to be a teenage boy or an elementary school boy working on the ranch. And I remember my grandfather telling me one time, you know, that you need to pay attention to both of them, because at the time he said, you know, those oranges pay for those cows, because the cattle business is famously not terribly profitable. As one old cracker rancher told me, cows are just an excuse to own land. You know, it certainly has brought us a lot of joy, and it's great to be part of the conservation ethic in Florida. It certainly is where the seeds of my passion for conservation in public life and my conservation ethic here at Ducks Unlimited began, you know, on the ranch with the abundance of wildlife living side by side with a more active use of the land and livestock that was feeding America and doing right by the land and doing right by my family. And so all of those things really came together, and a lot of those life lessons about how conservation and agriculture go arm in arm began on the ranch, mm-hmm. and a lot of the lessons about resilience and picking up and moving on after a devastating cold night began in the citrus groves.
Yeah, I grew up in, I mean, a little bit in Lakeland, but mostly in Sefner. And it's funny, you mentioned those years. And I would, if you'd asked me to mention the years where you had those hard freezes where you had the massive crop loss, I wouldn't be able to do it. But I do remember, and I'm, I think, about 3 or 4 years older than you, but I remember being in elementary school and into junior high and close to high school, where you had, you know, the news reporters on camera, on scene, you know, in groves and strawberry fields. And I remember being impacted, you know, and, you know, my dad worked for the federal government in those days. And so, but it was a community thing. And I can only imagine what it was like for you and your family, you know, up at night, you know, in the grove, trying to keep what you can, you know, alive, and then picking up the pieces afterwards. That's gotta leave a mark, doesn't it?
Well, it leaves a mark and teaches you lessons, and you look at the adults around you and how they react and how do they respond and mm-hmm. how do they handle it. And, you know, it teaches you a lot of lessons. And you're so right. It was a community feel, even mm-hmm. though not everyone in the community was necessarily growing strawberries or citrus or whatever. Everyone knew that it was going to be bad for the community mm-hmm. because, you know, of agriculture's role in the local economy. And I also remember the reporters standing out in the groves and under the icicles and the sprinklers running and, mm-hmm. and, you know, cutting up fruit on live television to show the ice inside the fruit and all of those kinds of things. It was a big deal, and it was a sense of loss for the entire community when you had those types of devastating activities, because, you know, unlike a hurricane, which devastates everyone, you know, everyone knew that the freeze was bad, but they didn't necessarily feel it personally, but they knew, but they had empathy for it. Mm. And they knew that it was going on and knew that it was going to be impacting people that they were close to in their lives, either as neighbors or people they go to church with or go to school with or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, it gives you, I think that's important, that shared sense of community.
Yeah, and you can draw, you know, as many tendrils as you want between, you know, some of these things I'm talking about and where you are. And I think it does inform, to some extent, I would assume, you know, the role that you've taken on, you know, in your current jobs. Like, but I'm looking at some of these things, those moments in time. I'm curious, you were big into 4-H when you were a kid. Did you do FFA as well? The Future Farmers of America was pretty much mostly 4-H in those days.
I did both. I was in 4-H longer than FFA, and I was more involved in 4-H than FFA, but I did both. You know, FFA, you generally join when you're, you know, in junior high, and, mm-hmm. and that was the situation with me. But yeah, I was ultimately a state officer in 4-H and was involved for 10 years.
Yeah, so I'm curious. I did FFA mostly because of the cool corduroy jackets.
That's right. Perfect for Florida, right?
That's right. But I'm curious. I mean, was it simply because, I mean, you're a farmer and agriculturalist, in your family was it simply expected that you would do something like that, or was it something you really enjoyed? And I think the thing I took the most of it was kind of like the leadership development side of what FFA did, you know, for me at that junior high and into high school level. Does 4-H have that same sort of mission as well, in terms of how do you connect young people with the land, with resources, with the world around them, and then also instill these leadership qualities?
Yeah, they're very similar in that regard, and they're very similar in, you know, learning by doing, empowering young people to have ownership of their decision making and take responsibility and, you know, care for, you know, like, you know, I was showing cattle in the county fair, and in my case it was a bull, not a steer, but doesn't care if it's Christmas, doesn't care if it's your birthday, doesn't care if it's cold, doesn't care if it's hot, you've got to get up and take care of that animal. Mm-hmm. And those types of life lessons are hugely important. The leadership development's tremendous, and I give both 4-H and FFA, but in my case especially 4-H, a ton of credit for training me in public speaking, because it's just it's embedded in every meeting, every opening ceremony, everything they do. You're standing up in front of your peers and giving a presentation or leading a discussion or taking a leadership role in it. You know, those are life skills, whether you stay in agriculture or not. And you know, those are the kinds of qualities that I think FFA and 4-H are famous for instilling in their members.
Do you think, I don't know, I mean, it's, you know, we see them, they come to Tallahassee on Ag Days and things like that, and it's great. And you can tell, like, these are kids that have their stuff together, engaged, smart, and all the things you would expect, you know, polite and, you know, good and nice to be around. Do you think we're missing some of that? When I look at education now, it's like, how are those things like FFA, are they going to survive in the educational structure that we have now? I mean, is the future strong for those organizations?
Well, I think it varies some from county to county. You have counties that still have very strong support for those programs and invest in them. You know, they're not cheap programs. It's, you know, it's not just four walls in a classroom. It's, you know, greenhouses and animal pens and feed bills and tractors and mowers and, you know, the host of equipment to really do it right. And some schools and school districts have kind of specialized where, you know, it may not be the right community to have a steer calf in, you know, behind the school, but they might have a greenhouse or they may have a garden or vice versa. So it the programs are still very strong. They are not as ubiquitous as they once were, but they're still very healthy, very strong, and still enjoy a lot of community support for all the reasons that you just identified. They're recognizing that they're producing really good citizens in life, regardless of whether they pursue a career in agriculture or not. They're just well-adjusted, great Americans who are ready to tackle the challenges of being a grown-up. And we need a lot more of that in life. And both of those programs excel at that.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.com. .us. All right, now back to the conversation. Tell me about you as a kid outside of your 4-H and FFA life. What were the kind of subjects that you enjoyed in school?
Well, I was, you know, more of a history, social studies kind of guy than math and algebra kind of guy. I've always been pretty upfront about that. I loved all of those type of subjects and classes and did well in them and kind of muddled along in algebra and geometry and all the other classes that you have to graduate. So in a STEM-centered world, I would not have been at the top of the heap. You know, I believe STEM is critically important. But I think it's also important for people to have a good grounding in the humanities and social sciences as well. You need both. The STEM courses, you know, they encourage us to develop our brains to solve problems and develop new innovative technologies and things that are really important to advancing human life. And the humanities allow us and encourage us to be creative problem solvers and ask questions like, why and how much and to what degree should we be doing these things relative to, you know, what's good for our souls or what's good for the body politic or whatever. And so you need all of those things. You need both of those things. It's what makes the world go around. Some are good at one, some are good at the other.
And so muddle or not, you graduate high school and you end up going to University of Florida. What did you study there and why? I mean, was the plan to get better at, you know, the agronomic side of the and go back and work in the family business? What was the plan at UF?
Well, that was certainly a potential plan, you know, at the very beginning. I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. Part of me thought I might want to go to law school. Part of me thought I might want to, you know, come back into the family citrus and cattle business. But I was the youngest of four, and, you know, my oldest brother had a 10-year head start, so it wasn't necessarily a foregone conclusion that was the right thing to do. But, you know, all those options were on the table. And like anybody else, I really wasn't entirely sure what I wanted to do. But I studied ag economics, which was technically called food and resource economics at the University of Florida, but it's agriculture economics. And my concentration was what they called natural resource economics, which really served me well. I never would have thought this was going to be as perfect a major as it actually ended up being. But natural resource economics, as opposed to regular economics is supply and demand, the curves, it's predictable, it's elastic or inelastic depending on what you're talking about, and it's, you know, it's pretty well rooted in, you know, allocation of scarce resources. Natural resource economics are, you know, how do economic laws revolve around things that, you know, don't have private property rights, don't have ownership, and have what they call in economics externalities. And so what are the economics of clean air? What are the economics of abundant fisheries? What are the economics of wildlife, where you're not talking about, you know, a defined factory producing X number of widgets at Y price, or you're not talking about 20 acres growing X at and accepting Y price from the buyer who comes along. You know, this is where, you know, what happens when, you know, you send out a fishing fleet in the Gulf of Mexico and they all have incentive to catch as many red snapper as they possibly can in as short a period of time as possible to set the market. And what happens when you begin to see the impacts on the population of the red snapper when they're not your red snapper. It's not like your herd of cattle where you have an economic incentive to make sure that you are being sustainable. Mm-hmm. And that's just one example of you know, what they call the tragedy of the commons or the impact of externalities, which are all the big cool words that I haven't used since my senior year at the University of Florida.
But, I mean, was water must have been involved in some of those discussions. And, I mean, being that...
Yeah, absolutely. It's like clean air, clean water. You know, what happens when you put a well in next to your neighbor's well, next to his neighbor's well, right, and everybody's got permission to pull water out, but at some point there's a tipping point and there's no water left. Well, you know, how do you allocate the risk? How do you allocate the cost? How do you allocate the value of something like clean water, clean air, fisheries, wildlife, things that don't have the usual incentives and disincentives attached to them that you would typically see in economics?
Does some of that, and things that you're mentioning, is like, not only are they a little more a literal impact on folks' lives, but also those things tend to, because of that, tend to slide over into politics. And so, you know, you've got this background now where you've done tons of public speaking. You're doing some of the same things in college, looking at your bio, you know, and then you have the subject matter to boot. Is there a storm brewing in terms of, like, when you're, you know, in those early years in college where you're like, gosh, maybe I can go out and make a difference in a different way?
Yeah, I think that's certainly where the stirrings of an interest in public service really began to form up a little more formally. I interned in Washington one summer in college for my congressman who's now on the Florida Supreme Court, Charles Kennedy. And, you know, with the thinking that maybe I would want to, after graduation, go to Washington, work on the Hill, be a staffer, you know, work on the Ag Committee or USDA or something like that, and apply all of these lessons that I, you know, thought that I was learning, you know, because when you're a senior in college, you think you've got it all figured out. And because they, you know, after all, they gave you a piece of paper to hang on the wall for all these tests that you've been taking for all these years.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I spent a summer there and thought that might be something that I was interested in doing and had a wonderful time and a lot of wonderful experiences. But that really did not turn out to be the experience that I thought I wanted to continue for post-graduation. So, yeah, which was great, right? Like, you want an internship to either open doors or close doors and help you, you know, kind of narrow down your choices. And it did that.
Yeah, I mean the same way. It's like, you know, even the bad experiences are still experiences, you know, that you get to take away an education regardless. But so then when did you make the decision then? You're in D.C., you know, maybe not your cup of tea at the moment. I mean, it ends up being your cup of tea for a little while. Were you a senior when you started campaigning to join the Florida House representatives? When did that decision happen for you?
I began exploring it. I wouldn't say I was campaigning as a senior, but I began, mm-hmm. you know, exploring the opportunity as a senior and, you know, looking at the maps and evaluating, you know, which communities would be the most influential in you know, swinging the vote and what the arithmetic of a path to winning actually looked like. Mm-hmm. All of that. Yeah, that did begin my senior year, and I graduated in December and announced not too terribly long after that. For, you know, that would have been in the, you know, like the first part of 1996 to be on the ballot in November of 1996. So when things started moving, they started moving pretty quickly.
Was part of the draw? I mean, it was a very interesting time, you know, in 1996. Whether you're 22 or Dan Webster, who is a newly minted Speaker of the House, in fact, the first one, I think it's since Reconstruction, like 120 years prior to that. Was that part of why you decided to do it then? Or was it really just, hey, I want to serve my community and this is why I'm getting into it? And it just so happens that there's a kind of a sea change in terms of at least, you know, some politics in Florida.
You know, I was thinking there's so many big issues going on. You're coming on the heels of the 94 Gingrich Revolution in Washington and big conversations about, you know, shrinking government and sending more power back to the states, big conversations about reforming entitlements and the debt and, you know, things that were generational in nature. And I felt like young people needed to have a seat at the table. You know, they were talking about complete overhauls in education, and yet, you know, many of the people on the education committees maybe hadn't been in school since, you know, before integration. So their frame of reference for what the schools were like and what the schools needed in the name of reform might have been, you know, outdated or obsolete, just as one example. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of conversation back then about the crime rate and juvenile justice, a lot of issues, you know, around other cultural ills. And I just felt like they needed young people, not just so that you have this representative form of government, but also because young people had a unique frame of reference, a unique perspective, and a unique set of skills that were needed at that time on the issues that were being debated. And I also felt like those kind of two windows of time in your life to really do this. One is, you know, kind of early before you are putting your children and your family through all of the rigmarole that goes with public life. And then later, you know, maybe when you're an empty nester kind of thing.
Right.
And then finally, you know, like, what do you have to lose? Right. You know, I mean, you're going to yeah. meet a ton of people. You're going to know your community. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to understand every aspect of many, many issues. Why not? You know, so yeah. that was going on. And yes, you mentioned Dan Webster. At the same time, the Florida Senate had just flipped for the first time in a long, that well, they were at a tie in 92, flipped in 94. And so now all the pressure was in 96 mm-hmm. on, you know, can you take back the House for the first time since Reconstruction? So, you know, there was kind of an energy out there, a vibe, especially, you know, after what had happened in D.C. elections in 94. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, all of that energy was kind of out there. It was a really exciting time to be involved in politics.
And I'm curious how that looked in, you know, that those early days from your perspective and your specific service. So I know you chaired the Agriculture Committee at one point, and I'm curious what the things that you focused on bringing that younger perspective, whether it's to the committee itself in terms of what the challenges that ag faced, you know, at that moment, but also maybe some of the natural resource kind of things, maybe some of the things that you even touch on now. What did that look like at the time?
You know, one of the differentiating features in my campaign was all about water. I mean, you mentioned water earlier, and that was the defining issue in my very first race and became a signature issue in every race after that. Nobody else was talking about water on the campaign trail, you know, and it really helped to differentiate me that I wasn't just, you know, ambitious kid fresh out of college who, you know, was just kind of, you know, against crime and for education. But there was a specific portfolio that I had that people really sort of sat up and started listening to. You know, Florida had been in an extended drought at that time, and there was a lot of conversations about coastal communities buying and drilling well fields in the interior of the state and then piping the water to the coast, because 80% of the population lived within 20 miles of the coast. So there was really, you know, the kind of a skirmish in what could have turned into a complete water war in Florida. And so, you know, representing an interior Central Florida House district, or rather running for that, I didn't represent it at the time, that resonated. It resonated not only with rural communities and farmers, but everyone, because, you know, essentially you had the potential that the coastal communities were going to stifle the economic development of the interior by locking up their water and moving it someplace else. And so that really was the number one issue. And I remember about 6 weeks, 2 months into the campaign, after, you know, giving multiple speeches a day to anybody who would listen at the Rotary Club or the Lions Club or the League of Women Voters, after a couple of months, I noticed that school board candidates and candidates that had nothing to do with running for the legislature were working into their stump speeches a paragraph about protecting Polk County's water. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I think there's something going on here. Like they're starting to parrot my talking points because they can see that this water topic has legs. And that's when I really thought, man, we got a shot here. We're going to be able to do this.
Wow. I mean, and it was tangible at the time. And you had the water wars, you know, going on between Hillsborough, Pinellas, and Pasco County in those days. And it was only a matter of time before, you know, like you said, somebody, you know, starts looking on the inside. And I worked, when I worked at Swift Mud many years ago, that's the Southwest Florida Water Management District, for some listeners that don't already know. And my area of coverage was Polk, Harding, Highlands County. And one is, you never just call it Polk County. It's always Imperial Polk County. And two is, you know, that it's the headwaters of four different systems. And so it's important. It was always drilled in those days. And this is the early 2000s, even in those days, that, you know, you've got to take care of what's going on there, because somebody could very well, you know, come and take that water and use it for something that you have literally nothing to do with whatsoever. So it really left a mark, you know, you're bringing that issue to the forefront, that is.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it really, and so that was, you know, part of the reason why I migrated into the, you know, natural resources committee space. You know, when I got to the legislature, I was on other committees, but, you know, I didn't aspire to chair the education committee. Yeah. You know, I was working in that what that time they called them councils, you know, natural resources, environmental protection, and agriculture. And so that was, you know, really, when you go to the legislature, you try to be known for being the go-to person on a particular set of issues, because no one can be an expert on everything. And you want to be the person that people ask your opinion on X. Mm-hmm. And in my case, it was ag and natural resource issues.
So you're doing really well. I mean, you know, like I mentioned, like you're on chairing a committee, which is a big deal for, you know, for someone that early. I mean, this is especially, you know, until you get into, you know, deep into the term limit times. But I want to ask, like, why did you then leave to run for Congress? Was it simply the opportunity presented itself, and those don't happen all that often, and you had to make the move? Or was there something that led you to want to go to Washington because you needed to address something that was on your mind?
I certainly wouldn't say that the fact that there was an open seat was not a factor. I mean, I'd be lying if I said that. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of other people who should have been ahead of me in line, who'd done their time, were more senior, were more tenured, and frankly, none of them were interested in upending their lives or their families' lives to go to Washington. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, you know, all the reasons that I'd said about going to Tallahassee in terms of the generational issues, they were playing out, those generational issues were playing out in a much, much larger way at the federal level at that time. The devolution, the debt, the future of Social Security and Medicare, the entitlement the issues that, you know, were generational in nature, what, you know, what the United States could or should do with a peace dividend from the end of the Cold War, and kind of the lingering questions about that, even though by then you were now into the, you know, Bosnian situation. But all of those were just big, big generational issues. And you know, the other thing in Florida, you know, you, because of term limits, you're kind of stifling someone's ability to really, you know, kind of grow, develop, and become an expert in a particular portfolio of issues. And Charles Kennedy was keeping his word on his self-imposed term limits pledge. Mm-hmm. It made sense to make that move. I visited with a lot of other folks who I had a ton of respect for, who I thought would have run for it before I decided to, and to a person, they took a pass and said, that is not something I'm interested in doing to my family or to myself.
All right, let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. When I say the names Andrew, Ian, Irma, and Michael, what immediately enters your mind? If you answered hurricanes, congratulations, you're a Floridian. We all know that hurricanes bring devastating wind, rain, and storm surge. What you may not already know is that my friends at Sea and Shoreline are the leading innovators in the quest to mitigate the destructive wave energy of storm surges with their patented wave attenuation devices, or WADs. Not only can WADs protect against the effects of storm surge, they can also protect our beaches and shorelines from the massive erosion events that tropical storms and hurricanes bring. In fact, WADs have been shown to increase shoreline accretion. That's right. Their technology can help build shorelines. Sea and Shoreline is committed to protecting and preserving Florida's communities and coastlines because they are Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to protect your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, now back to the conversation. Let me read a quote to you, and you tell me, you know, how it resonates with you. And it's from Dan Rollerson, and at one time, he described your time in elected office as being done out of obligation rather than aspiration. Does that ring true to you? And if so, is like, is that something that's family built, or is it something that you developed as you saw that you were, gosh, you're kind of good at doing this?
Well, I mean, that's a wonderful, kind thing that he said, and you know, I think there is a lot of truth to it. I would not say that I had no aspiration or no ego or no ambition in, you know, involved in these decisions. I would not trust anyone who says that they have no ambition and no ego and yet want to go ask 600,000 people to vote for them. You know, like those two things are inherently in conflict. Mm-hmm. But there is an obligation, and I believe all of us have an obligation to give back and to serve in some way. Not everybody wants to run for office. Not everybody needs to or should, but all of us have an obligation to give back in our own way and participate in this Tocquevillian image of a democratic republic, whether it's leading the Rotary Club or volunteering for the PTA or, you know, supporting the 4-H Club or the Scout Troop or running for mayor or school board. You know, all of those are kind of thankless jobs, but if everybody takes one of them, then life gets a lot better and our kids turn out better and our communities are stronger. And so there is an obligation, and that obligation to be involved and not just stay at home and complain about things, but, you know, roll up your sleeves and do something about it. That was certainly instilled in me, not necessarily putting your name on a ballot. My parents were not terribly political, and when I told my dad that I was thinking about running for the legislature, he was just silent for what seemed like forever. And finally I said, well, don't you have any words of wisdom to say, or, you know, some fatherly advice? And he just looked at me and said, I don't know what to say. It's like you just told me you were pregnant or something.
What did he say when you wanted to go to D.C. at that point? Was that even like strange? Because it's still, you're still spending a huge amount of time in the Florida legislature, but that's got to decrease, you know, as you rise up in the ranks rather quickly in Congress, right?
Yeah, I mean, the way the legislature is built in Florida, not every state's like this, but the way it is in Florida, I think, is a really good way of doing it. It is part-time, and it is designed for people to leave their normal jobs for some period of time and go make collectively the best decisions for the state and then go back to their jobs and live with those decisions. And as a result, state laws are a lot more fluid. I mean, they quickly decide something is not working and change it, or something is working and add more of it. Whereas in D.C., because it's just a constant slog and everyone's there all year anyway, there's not really a sense of urgency. And things take actually years and years to get passed. And once they do get passed, even if everyone knows that it didn't turn out the way that you hoped it would or intended it to, no one really wants to admit that they just wasted all these years passing something that didn't work, and so they're reluctant to change it. And so the dynamic nature of that citizen legislature in Florida, I think, serves its people really well. Even a rapidly growing state that's now the third largest state, it still serves them well. Whereas, you know, a lot of other states that are large have gone to a full-time legislature, and I don't think that you get more bang for your buck by having legislators in all the time. And right. So, yeah, the shift to D.C. certainly means that this is going to be what you do full time, because that's just the nature of how Congress works.
You didn't stay all that long. I mean, 5 terms is pretty good, but there are folks that in Congress before either one of us was born. And so was that part of how you saw when you eventually decided to leave and run for ag commissioner in Florida? Was the frustration of that part of it, where you're used to being able to make real tangible change in a year or two, a session or two, and now it's not happening like that anymore?
That was certainly part of it. That wasn't all of it, but that was part of it. You know, by the time I left Congress, we had 4 young children. When I got there, we were expecting our first. And so the cost-benefit analysis of missing all the things that I missed with 4 young, increasingly active children who had ball games and dance recitals and soccer and swim meets and all of those kinds of things versus, am I still making a difference or could someone else from my community do this? Mm. And, you know, there's lots of great people who could be congressmen. There's only one person who can be my children's father. Mm. You know, all of that really weighed on me as much as anything in terms of some frustration with the pace, some frustration with the direction, but mostly more personal considerations of, I'm not sure that, you know, leaving my family every Monday to get on a plane to go to D.C. and just throw rocks at each other is necessarily what I signed up for or the reason why I knocked on, you know, 15,000 doors to be here. And again, you know, there was a unique opportunity in the fact that a position that I had always regarded very highly and as ag commissioner and felt like my time in public life fit beautifully with the responsibilities of ag commissioner. That was very appealing. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It was pretty exciting to think about running statewide mm-hmm. in a state as huge as Florida is and as diverse as Florida is. And then being able to focus every day on the issues that I am the most passionate about and be in the executive branch where you can really go drive an agenda and right. do things pretty quickly and frankly be held accountable for whether you're successful at driving that agenda or not. That was all of that was very appealing. And I loved every minute of my time as commissioner. We had a great department, a great team of people, a shared culture, a shared passion for doing things the right way for the right reasons to benefit everyone. And it was magical.
Can you, for listeners that don't know, that particular cabinet position, the commissioner's position, is, I think, has much more to do on a broad scope of things. They think, oh gosh, you're the one that deals with box taxes on citrus or something, right? And the answer is you cover all sorts of things. Can you talk, you know, just give people an idea of the breadth of issues that in your responsibility?
Yeah, it's big. Yeah, it's the largest State Department of Agriculture in the country. It's a $1.3 billion budget, you know, several thousand employees. So you've got the sort of the obvious agricultural pieces of it. The less obvious agricultural pieces, you know, regulating pesticides and fertilizers And then you get into the really less obvious things that most people aren't aware that Department of Ag does, food safety, what they call weights and measures, which are all the scales at the airport and the grocery store, from the deli to the pawn shop to the jewelry store to the post office to the luggage counter at the airport. Ride safety, you know, in a state like Florida, you're not just talking about county fairs. You're talking about Disney, Busch Gardens, SeaWorld, Universal, where you're, you know, making sure that millions of visitors per year are in a are riding safely. In addition to that, it's a cabinet position, so you're dealing with all the bonds that the state issues, the debt that the state incurs, the clemency and pardons and paroles process that are affiliated with the governor, the attorney general, the CFO, and the ag commissioner. You are all state lands that are coming before the cabinet, those issues. You know, we're managing, you know, 1 million acres of state forests and, a 1,000 forest land firefighters who are part of the Forest Service. And then, you know, one of my signature issues that I'm still real proud of, we took over the school lunch program. Mm-hmm. So we were responsible for, you know, feeding several million school children every day, 180 days of the year.
Yeah. I mean, I think some really incredible accomplishments. I mean, there is, I mean, marks that people experience in their everyday lives, you know, even right now. And I know well into the future. I mean, it's such a huge job, and you got to do it twice, which is pretty cool. But I want to ask you, I mean, in terms of agriculture, these issues pop up time to time when you look at agriculture's relationship with a state. As you said, it's a huge state, third largest in the country, that's been built around farms, that's been built around these areas. Can you make your best case for people out there, for someone that doesn't understand agriculture and Florida, why the survival of agriculture is so important?
Well, I think I'm really enthusiastic about the attention that the legislature has given the wildlife corridor, and a recognition that through easements and the wildlife corridor and the Rural Lands Stewardship Act, that agriculture is not only feeding us and generating the second largest economic activity behind tourism in the state, but it is essential to our quality of life. Clean water, abundant wildlife, green spaces, places to be outdoors, resiliency, you know, healthy wetlands as buffers and shock absorbers for hurricanes, and flood storage that keeps it, you know, on open spaces instead of in neighborhoods. There is a growing recognition of that. And all of those benefits are coming from something that is also producing jobs, supporting local communities, adding to the tax base, and contributing to the economic vitality of the third largest state. And so that's pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. And in Florida, unlike a lot of states that might, you know, be known for four crops, you know, they might be corn, rice, and soybeans, or, you know, right, hogs and wheat. In Florida, you know, you're talking like 300 different commodities, from stone crabs to blueberries and peaches and citrus and mangoes and all the tropical fruits coming out of South Florida, and avocados and timber, pine trees, cattle, dairy, all of that. So just great diversity, great use of the landscape, and certainly great economic drivers. All of those things add to quality of life, and there's a growing recognition of that and a growing willingness to pay or to invest to keep those things on the landscape. And that's going to, future generations are going to thank us for those.
Can I hit on something, maybe it's a little more direct and personal, because we talked about freezes before, but we didn't talk about the other issues that hit the citrus industry from the time that we were kids to now. You look at canker, then it was greening, you know, and of course sprawl, where it makes more sense to sell to development than to keep losing money on when you have, you know, those problems that are incumbent to your business. Can citrus survive in Florida? And if so, is like, what does that future look like in your mind?
Well, the short answer is it can survive, but it's a shadow of its former self. We will never see the 280 or 300 million boxes of citrus production again that we saw in the 90s for a variety of reasons, but the biggest reason is citrus greening. We've now had it for over 15 years. We've invested over $1 billion to find a solution to it. and we have found Band-Aids and temporary fixes, but we have not found a solution or a cure or even a long-term effective treatment. There's some promising things out there, and you've got a lot of really hardworking entrepreneurial people, and including, you know, my family, who are still out there trying to find a way to make it work.
Right.
You know, you've got processors who the processing capacity, because Florida is a juice state, mm-hmm. that were built for, you know, a 200 or 300 million box supply, that, you know, are going to struggle to justify opening to run what will be probably, you know, before it's all over with, an 8 to 10 million box supply after the impacts of the hurricanes on the 15 million box estimate pre-storm. And so, you know, any one of the plants in Florida can run that on their own. You're seeing innovation and new technologies like growing citrus under what they call protective screen, which is, you know, growing them in basically under like a mosquito net,
right,
like you'd put over a bed. So, you know, water can get to it, sunlight can get to it, but bugs can't. And that certainly enhances the lifespan and the productivity of those trees, and it, at a more expensive cost of production. But they're selling that fruit in the fresh fruit market and are able to make the economics work until hurricanes come along and blow over the screens, which is what we've seen in the last, right, several hurricane years. Will there continue to be citrus? Absolutely. Will it continue to change on the landscape? It will. You know, if they came up with a cure tomorrow, I think you would see a lot of capital move off the sidelines and come back into it. But absent that, you know, the risks out there not having a solid solution for greening are just still weighing heavily on anyone's interest in investing in a big way into citrus.
I know this may be, you know, an unfair question or me just asking you to guess, but is there the next citrus? Let's say, you know, the in terms of acreage, and I still spend a fair amount of time in Polk County, and you drive through and you see, you know, some that are gone fallow, some with the, you know, like you said, the mosquito nets on the trees. If you're not going to grow citrus, is there the next thing out there that folks are looking at? Is it blueberries? Is it something that's more fiber related that folks are looking at? Do you have any prognostication there?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that people have tried and are continuing to try. There is not one single obvious alternative to citrus on that landscape. Citrus loves sandy, high, dry, well-draining soils. And, you know, there's a limited number of other things that share that trait. You know, your berries and your other things, mm-hmm. are going to want something that's going to hold a little more moisture, whereas, you know, citrus hates to have wet feet. Mm-hmm. But you are seeing, you know, you've seen blueberries. They've kind of had their moment. They're still around. Their acreage has declined some because of competition from Mexico in particular. Peaches had a moment, and you've seen some backsliding on the acreage there on former citrus lands. You're seeing a lot of the berry guys getting pushed out by development from Eastern Hillsborough County, and they're taking over former citrus lands, and they're making up beautiful berry plants in Polk County in places that used to be oranges as far as the eye could see. But you know, there's not just the one single alternative that's going to replace, you know, what was, you know, 800,000 acre crop at one time in Florida.
I think it's a probably pretty good point, you know, to segue into your current work and the challenges as well at Ducks Unlimited. And I say that because, you know, part of it is, you know, does ag become remain agriculture or does it become development? But regardless where you are, and I want you to talk, you know, about what Ducks Unlimited does, but kind of where you are in terms of what that sort of loss means for the folks that care about your membership and the folks that care about the things that you care about now. If you can just explain what Ducks Unlimited is.
Yeah, so Ducks Unlimited began during the Dust Bowl in the late 1930s, a record drought. You know, the Midwest was blowing away, and there was a collapse in the number of waterfowl that migrate. They're born in the U.S. and Canadian prairies and then fly south every winter and fly north every spring. And a group of dedicated duck hunters came together in the 1930s and said, you know, we need to do something about this if future generations are going to have the ability to hunt waterfowl. And so they created Ducks Unlimited to protect the breeding grounds on the U.S. and Canadian prairies. In fact, originally just the Canadian prairies, because that's where their dollar would go further. And over time, DU has become the largest wetlands conservation organization in the world. We do work only in North America, and so our work is in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And we have, you know, we protect, conserve, restore wetlands and related habitats for waterfowl, other wildlife, and for people. And we have grown it in the last 5 years to the point that last year we conserved 1 million acres of habitat in a single year, which is, you know, just almost incomprehensible. You can count on one hand the number of organizations who have that kind of impact, and you'd have like 3 fingers left over. You know, DU and Nature Conservancy would be like the two that are making that kind of an impact. And we do it with volunteers. We have over 30,000 volunteers who put on 5,000 events a year at the grassroots level to raise money for these projects. So DU is a really fascinating company. It's, you know, it's this grassroots, volunteer-led fundraising organization that also is an engineering and construction and design firm that also has some of the premier waterfowl scientists and waterfowl biologists and agronomists also under that roof, among other things. So you've got this development team, this conservation team, this events fundraising team, and then the back office to support it on a continental basis. We can't do what we do without partners in agriculture. Farmers and ranchers own the habitat. They own the land in the U.S. and Canada in particular, and they are our partners. And so when DU approached me about applying for the job, they were looking for someone who had connections and relationships and a background in agriculture and understood what farmers and ranchers go through and what they're looking for in a partner like a DU. And ideally, someone, they were looking for someone who had a public policy background, because more and more local governments and state governments and even the feds are investing in habitat, either for the benefit of clean water or the benefit of ducks or the benefit of carbon or the benefit of flood resilience or any number of benefits that our work provides. And so it's an extension of what I've done my whole life, but I just don't have to stand for election every 2 years to do it. So it's public service without public life.
Can you give an example maybe of one of those projects / partnerships, you know, that, you know, maybe here in Florida, I know you've got a huge swath of territory, but maybe give an example for folks to kind of get a feel for how you do that.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple that are Florida-based. One is a partnership between Ducks Unlimited and the University of Florida, where a very large acreage near Yeehaw Junction on the Florida Turnpike and Highway 60, where it was going to be turned into a new city in the middle of the state. The city didn't get off the ground, and we were approached by a very generous conservation-minded donor who donated the land, the, you know, 27,000 acres or so to the University of Florida. The easement on the land, the conservation easement that guaranteed it would never be developed, donated that to Ducks Unlimited. And so we partner with the University of Florida on education and outreach and research on, you know, the complementary nature of cattle grazing with wildlife and endangered species, including waterfowl, but not just waterfowl. And it's just a gem. It's a treasure in Central Florida. Another example would be in the Panhandle, where we are actually restoring wetlands that had been drained or had been altered, and we're using some of the BP oil spill funds in partnership with Florida Game and Fish and DEP to actually put that land back together and restore it to its natural functioning state. And then we're doing some work in Everglades National Park as well, in terms of restoring, you know, basically filling in canals that were dug decades ago and restoring that natural habitat. So even in Florida, which is not exactly the center of the duck universe, although we have an awful lot of migrating birds come through, mm-hmm. DU does a lot in our state.
Can I ask you about kind of the environment you created, the culture at Ducks Unlimited? And I was reading through materials, looking at your website, and I was struck by some of the elements of what you call your organization's core values. And specifically, I'm thinking of those areas where you've, and I think it's specifically ethics, team DU, collaboration, not confrontation, and passion and commitment. And there seems to be a thread that runs through these areas that don't just concentrate on how you're perceived by the outside world, which I know is important, and you're a big part of that, but more so about your own culture and how you view yourselves as collaborators and individuals within that organization. I'm curious, is that by design, and how is that going for you?
Well, it has served DU incredibly well for the life of the organization since 1937. I can't take credit for the culture. My job is to protect that culture and enhance that culture, but that culture existed before Adam Putnam arrived here. And, you know, our job is to continue to attract people who share those values and want to advance that culture and retain the best and the brightest of those who have already joined us. And we're very good at that. We have very low churn, very low turnover. People who come to DU tend to stay at DU. Mm. We're pretty good at being a magnet for talent from other state agencies or federal government or other NGOs or even from the private sector who want to make a difference in life. They want to have a successful career, but a significant career, a meaningful career that's leaving the world better than they found it. And that's what we offer. And because of our diversity from engineering and GIS and biology and agronomy to the development and fundraising and PR and video production and graphic design, we can attract a wide range of skill sets and talents, but protecting that culture is essential. And, you know, I was on a employee podcast essentially earlier today, and we were talking about, you know, I've always said that culture eats strategy for lunch. It's not my original quote, but I believe it. And I repeat it often. And, you know, we faced an existential threat at Ducks Unlimited with COVID and the shutdown of in-person events. And we're, you know, those are the lifeblood of how we raise unrestricted dollars. Mm-hmm. But we got through it and came through it even stronger than we were before. It wasn't because we had a strategy for dealing with a global pandemic. That was not a three-ring binder on the shelf that we were prepared to pull out in case of emergency. Right. It was our culture that got us through that crisis and allowed us to emerge stronger and leaner and meaner and better and more effective.
And so then let's move to the, you know, some things that, you know, as you said, like they stood before you were there and your job is to protect it. But let's talk about the things that you do probably, maybe, get yourself involved in. And so for me, it's like the thing that I've always known about you was you're a policy guy. You're a policy wonk. And you've talked about that a few times already in terms of, you know, how you view that. And now you're at the helm of a national organization. And so I'm curious how involved you get in policy issues back home in Florida at this point, being as, you know, it's your home. I know you're in Memphis now, but, you know, how do you view those issues back home, and do you get involved at all?
Well, I certainly keep my finger on the pulse of things in Florida. I still have a home there and I'm back there quite a bit. I have one foot there and one foot in mm-hmm. Tennessee when I'm not in a Delta lounge flying somewhere else. But yeah, I certainly, you know, pay attention to what's still going on back there and watch it closely. But I also get the benefit of being able to watch what's going on. And, you know, I was just with the Secretary of Agriculture in Iowa, and with the auditor in Iowa, and with, you know, policymakers in other states or visiting our partners in Washington. So there's a lot of overlap between, you know, what I did as ag commissioner in Florida. And, you know, I kind of joke this is like being ag commissioner for the country. You're going to out of the way places that are beautiful, full of wonderful, friendly people that most people don't even know still exist anymore. Right. And there's a shared sense of mission and purpose about where we're going. And it's just idyllic. But, you know, all that is kind of a long way of saying that, you know, I certainly don't pay as close attention as I once did, but I still try to pay pretty close attention to it because it matters.
Well, then let me shift to something maybe a little more national, a little more tangible all over. And so how do you, in your role at DU, view the ever shifting, it seems, and regulatory framework related to how we deal with wetlands and waters of the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, I know that it's just incredibly frustrating for everyone, whether it's for the landowner, the farmer who has potholes and they're wondering whether they're federal or state. It's frustrating for the regulator. It's frustrating for an NGO, you know, a wetlands conservation organization like ours, that there's no consistency, there's no stability, the rules keep changing, the definitions keep changing, and so, you know, nobody really knows who's on first. And I know why it makes landowners crazy, because I'm a landowner, and I know why it undermines people's confidence in how all these things work. You know, I think that, you know, people want clarity, people want consistency, people want the law not to change every 2 years or every time that there's a new judge's decision, or in the case of Waters of the U.S., have different parts of the country playing by different rules based on which judicial circuit that they are in. You know, DU values those prairie potholes in particular very much, because that's where all of the birds in North America, all the migrating waterfowl in North America, are born and bred. So, you know, we want to work with farmers to have them farm around those potholes, but leave them for wildlife, not just birds, but other wildlife, and the value that they present in terms of aquifer recharge, nutrient removal, and all of the other benefits to all of society when you have those healthy functioning watersheds. I don't blame a farmer for not, you know, wanting to have to hire a hydrologist and an attorney to know what they can farm and what they can't. Yeah. And so, you know, it'd be nice if we got a clear definition and stuck with it.
All right, let's move to my next unfair question, but curiosity requires me. Well, not just curiosity, but curiosity in anyone that I told that I was going to get to talk to you today has asked me to ask you anyway. You're barely 50 years old, and we talked a little earlier about when you do things related to public service, and one of those is early on, before you have kids and before they get to the age where you're missing things, and then it's empty nester. And yeah, I'm trying to keep track here of the timeline and the years. And so I'm curious, though, you spent nearly your entire life in public service as an elected official, and a successful one at that, effective, you know, by, I think, all accounts. Are you done with politics, or is there still a chance for something down the road for you?
You know, I think it's highly unlikely that I would get back into politics. And I guess, you know, you never say what you'd never do. But, I've had a wonderful career in public life at the state level, at the statewide level, and at the federal level. And so, and on top of that, most importantly, I'm in a role now where I feel fulfilled in public service, that what we are doing is a public service. The mission of DU, the success that we're having, the impact that we're having, you know, it really is public service without public life. It's all of the good and none of the bad. And so, you know, I guess I'd say I've been there and got the t-shirt. Nice. Why go back? Why grab the stove again?
It does sound like a legitimately cool job. Like to be able to do what you do, to have your hand in so many places and work on these issues. Yeah, it's gotta be gratifying for you to be able to do it.
It is. I mean, gratifying doesn't begin to describe it. It's wonderful.
So before I move on to, I have a standard list of questions I ask everyone that comes on the show, but I do want folks to be able to find out more about what Ducks Unlimited is up to and how they can engage directly with the good work that you and your team are doing. How do they do that?
Well, the easiest way is to check out our website at ducks.org. You can spend as much time there as you want. It can lead you in all sorts of directions about the wonderful work that we're doing across the continent, links to some of our TV shows and our magazines and ways to join and make a difference for wetlands, waterfowl, and people.
I think people recognize the upgrade in production value for sure. That's if you go and see their shows. And I definitely recommend that folks go do that. Okay, so are you optimistic? And I'm focusing on Florida here, but you can expand it wider if you like. But are you optimistic about the future of the environment and natural systems in Florida, and why, either way?
I am optimistic, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, which is that there is a recognition that, you know, the rate of growth of the state, the, you know, nearly 1,000 new people moving there per day, that there is an obligation to invest in conservation, to invest in open spaces and wildlife corridors and places that will never be built, and to invest in easements that allow that land to stay on the tax roll, stay in food production, stay in, you know, employing people, but also not ever be developed on a, you know, by the landowner entering into a voluntary conservation easement and being paid some fair price for taking that option off their table and off all future owners' tables. So, you know, the leadership of the legislature and the continued leadership of the legislature will, you know, has made this a public priority, and they've put their money where their mouth is. And so it's exciting to see that. And I think, as I said earlier, future generations will thank us for protecting those open spaces in a state like Florida.
And I guess on that note and toward that end, it's like, what, if anything, and maybe that's it, worries you about the future of Florida's environment and natural spaces?
Yeah, there's plenty to worry about. You know, I mean, it breaks my heart to think about what we've lost in our coral reefs and, you know, the record high temperatures that we saw in the Gulf the last two summers that have accelerated the bleaching. I was on the Florida Fish and Wildlife Foundation for a while, and the work that they're doing with other partners on restoring coral and trying to find ways to grow it out in other places and then put it back into the wild and heal our reefs is important. But, you know, we're losing that battle so far. You know, wetlands are essential. And, you know, when you look at the storms, the number of storms and things that we've had, you know, we need to have healthy mangrove systems and healthy coastal wetlands to absorb that surge and absorb the wind and the water that those storms are bringing. And, you know, so places like the 10,000 Islands are just irreplaceable and really special. Obviously, the Everglades, Lake Okeechobee and the releases there continue to, you know, to be a challenge. We want to see that be a healthy functioning lake, but it's kind of hard to have a healthy functioning natural lake when it's got a dike all the way around it. So you have to make trade-offs, right? If you're going to have human safety in a state that's got, you know, as many people as we have and living where they do, you know, it's all about finding the right balance. You know, our springs are special, and, you know, we continue to work to find ways to restore the health of our springs that, you know, where I've got so many fond memories as a kid growing up in those crystal clear waters and, you know, getting my checkout dive for scuba and everything else in places like Devil's Den. And you know, you want to see them recover and get that clarity back.
What advice would you give to young people who are just entering or even have an interest in entering public service, whether that's government or that's service organization like the one that you run now?
I say go get them. I mean, I love the fact I want to see more young people who have an interest in public service. My fear, my concern is that, you know, young people have grown up in such a cynical age with, you know, where, you know, the comedy, you know, the late night comedy might be their source of news. And so they're jaded, they're cynical, they're pessimistic. They've lived through some, you know, tough events in a short period of time that have just rocked our country. And so, you know, my fear is that there's fewer and fewer people who are willing to put themselves into public service. So when I run across someone who is interested in it and passionate about it and wanting to do it for the right reasons, I might warn them, you know, I might give them a little bit of eyes wide open type advice, but I'm certainly going to encourage them to do that because we need more of that to tackle the problems that we face as a country to make sure that we remain the shining city on a hill that future generations will aspire to be a part of.
Well said. I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you so much for your time. And Adam Putnam, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate you.
Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. And thank you once again to Rez and Sea and Shoreline for making it possible. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod, and you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Soren for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.